Hello and welcome back, and thanks for listening. This is Techonomics, and I'm Jason Middleton. This week, we're getting a little outside of this show's brief. Again, there's no real tech angle, unless you count the crude animations mentioned. And there's no real economic effect, although when a creative and enterprise project has been going for 50 years, there's something of note in itself there. This week is this, what was once known as Gwen Dibley's Flying Circus.
Is it true that the BBC wanted Flying Circus in the title? And
the BBC had to call it something on their schedule, so they started calling it by the name of the executive who was in charge. He was Barry Took, and they called it Barry Took's Flying Circus. And we rather liked Flying Circus. Yeah. And then we had to decide whose it was. And then we thought it might be Gwen Dibley's, because who was she?
Well, I just found my mother-in-law's one quiet weekend, and she was reading a magazine of the Towns Women's Guild, the sort of people who do good work in the counties of England. And in each of these places, they had embroidery classes and flower arranging and all that. Flower arranging! And they also had a little bit where it said, accompanied by Gwen Dibley on the piano. The name Gwen Dibley sort of intrigued me, and I thought, how nice it would be to give someone their own series without them knowing. So they would, only when the listings came out for that weekend, Gwen Dibley, the family would say, Mum, you've got the series on television.
That was a panel of the surviving members of Monty Python's Flying Circus speaking with Robert Klein on stage in Aspen in 1998. Gwen Dibley's Flying Circus became Monty Python, of course, and 2019 is the 50th anniversary of the group's creation. Broadcast by the BBC between 1969 and 1974, Monty Python's Flying Circus introduced something completely different, a new brand of surrealistic stream-of-consciousness comedy that pushed the traditional boundaries of format, style, and content. Coming up is the author and a definitive Python scholar who has a new edition of his book. Monty Python Speaks, the Complete Oral History, Revised and Updated. All right, all things Monty Python with the author of a definitive book on Python. Here we go.
David Morgan, I'm the author of the book Monty Python Speaks.
Okay, so I picked up my kid, 9-year-old daughter, yesterday from school. I had been doing my notes for this interview, so the book was out, my notes were out. She walks in, she picks up the book and goes, Monty Python, I can't wait, I claim this. And she just takes the book. and it occurred to me that what these people created just goes across so many decades. It must have been a wonderful book to work on, but can we talk about the universality of the appeal and charm of Monty Python?
Oh, yeah. It really has transcended generations and borders. And one of the reasons for that is probably because they never dealt much in the way of topical humor. You don't have to know who was the prime minister in England in 1969 in order to get a joke, because right. They dealt with archetypes primarily, establishment figures, government officials, military, police, royal family, and anyone in any time period in any country can get those jokes. So it did have a universality that a lot of other comedy on TV at the time did not have.
Right.
You can't, for example, watch Laughing today.
That's true.
And get half of the jokes.
You get half the Nixon jokes.
Yeah.
Right.
Or any jokes. Whoever was in the news that week, they made fun of. And of course, it means nothing to us now.
Right. And to enjoy Monty Python, you don't have to know how to raise a parrot to know when a parrot is dead. So
I think everybody knows when a parrot is dead.
When it has ceased to be. Really, I mean, I know you obviously are so well-versed in this, but I have to say that it just, what Monty Python lent us as far as part of the lexicon, the way that we culturally lean on it in so many different ways is kind of almost like Chaucer in a lot of ways, sometimes maybe even Shakespeare. Would you agree?
Yeah, I never thought of them as a 20th century Chaucer, but yeah, I guess. It is something that people feel very passionate about, especially if they glommed onto Python in their younger years. And they are eager to share it with other Python fans. That's why the quotes, the sketches are repeated so frequently.
Well, I'm holding in my hand Monty Python Speaks, the Complete Oral History, Revised and Updated Edition. Let's start at the very beginning. What was the impetus for pulling this together? And then we'll talk about what you've added in this new edition.
At a much younger age, I was a big fan of Python. And as a journalist, I've interviewed one or more of them over the years since going back to the 1980s. And so when they were coming up in their 30th anniversary, I wanted to to do a sort of history, but not just behind the scenes of what it was like to make the TV shows and the films, but also what really interested me was how these six very strong comic personalities were able to mesh into a single comic sensibility that is Monty Python, and that's quite unlike what any of them have done in their solo work. If you look at, say, for example, John Cleese's Fawlty Towers, mm-hmm. it's a great situation comedy, but it's really nothing like Python. Terry Gilliam's films are really not quite like Python, or certainly Michael Palin's travel series, or Eric Idle's concerts, or Terry Jones's books about medieval history, Chaucer. Right. They're not Pythonic, and yet when they all got together, they were able to create something that was, in some respects, even greater than the singular parts.
Yes, and that leads me to a question that was actually fed to me from another family member who's a big fan of Monty Python. They must have felt like they were walking off a bit of a cliff when they started to get together. They didn't necessarily, I'm going back to the word of universality of absurdity, they pulled that mm-hmm. together. When, in your inclination as a journalist and when you were reporting and compiling the book, when do you think that they kind of knew or felt their success?
Well, many of them had been working, they had known each other since university days from Cambridge and Oxford. That's when John Cleese and Graham Chapman began working as a writing team. Eric Idle was also at Cambridge. And Michael Palin and Terry Jones were at Oxford, and they were writing and performing together. And they're all pursuing what you might call like standard, respectable professions in school. But upon graduation, they all took jobs writing comedy for BBC radio and television. And they worked together in various groupings or couplings for a number of shows during the 1960s for people like David Frost. And then in 1969, the BBC gave them the opportunity to write and perform their own show. And the BBC basically gave them carte blanche. He said, you can do whatever you want. And the Pythons did whatever they wanted. They had this enormous freedom to break the standards that they had been required to work under for all these other people like David Frost. For example, they could do sketches and forget about a punchline, because right. the punchline to them was the least important part of the sketch. And then they would just jump onto the next comic idea and the next one and the next one. And it'd be tied together with all these surreal animated bits that the American in the group, Terry Gilliam, provided. So it was very much a sort of stream of consciousness flow for an episode. It wasn't built around narrative or characters. It was just basically an explosion of comic ideas one to the next. And that was liberating for them. And it was liberating for the audience, too. I think that's why people right. gravitated it to so much, because it really was unlike anything that they had seen on TV.
The book obviously is filled with wonderful anecdotes, and you mentioned Terry Gilliam there and his animation. The story of how he became an animator is amazing. He just kind of said, hey, let me do an animation. They said, okay. And they gave him 2 weeks and yeah. 400 pounds, and the next day he had offers from all over the place because of the popularity.
Yes, because it was shown on TV, and suddenly he became an animator rather than just a cartoonist. It created a new profession for him.
Let's talk about Footlights real quick, too, right? Because Footlights was kind of the incubator for Monty Python.
Yeah, in many respects, certainly in the early 60s, that was college group at Cambridge, where people wrote and performed reviews. And they would sometimes take them on the road, like to the Edinburgh Festival, or even in the case of Cleese and Graham, it went to London's West End and ultimately to Off-Broadway. And so this was a jumping off point for a lot of comic talents, not just for the Pythons, but people like Tim Brooke Taylor and Graham Garden and Bill Oddie, who became the comedy group The Goodies. That really gave them a taste of writing and performing that they didn't have a chance before going to Cambridge. And that's mm-hmm. why I think it was so attractive to them when the possibility came that, hey, we can make a career out of this at the BBC.
Right on. A footnote about that, too, is that Eric Idle was president and allowed women to be full-time members for the first time, which I thought was also a very forward-thinking all the way around. You have dozens and dozens of examples of Python-adjacent people, as well as the principal Pythons. But Doug Adams kind of jumped out to me. Can we talk a little bit about what Doug Adams thought and contributed to the Pythons?
Douglas Adams is best known for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He was also at Cambridge, a few years behind the others. And he had gotten to know John Cleese and also Graham Garden, Graham Chapman. And he had collaborated with Graham on a few bits, including some pieces that ended up on the Python album for Holy Grail. And so he even appeared in bit parts in the fourth series of Monty Python's Flying Circus. He went when they were filming around the country, and so he would pop in here and there in the background. So he sort of jealously guarded that he has one toe in the Python universe, but he really did have a similar sensibility. And so in later years, he did collaborate with Terry Jones in some projects and John Cleese. So he fits comfortably into the Python universe.
For sure. That was David Morgan, author of Monty Python Speaks, The Complete Oral History Revised and Updated Edition. But wait, there's more. Coming up in the next segment, we get right back at it with David Morgan. So please stick around. This is Techonomics, and I'm Jason Middleton, and it's...